Welcome to episode one of Let's Talk HCS. I'm excited to welcome our host of Real Talk, David Carroll.
Hey, it's good to be here, and this is going to be fun. It's an HCS podcast, and we're going to kick things off with a Real Talk segment. I'll be hosting these every 6 weeks, and we'll dig into some timely questions about the school district with Superintendent Dr. Justin Robertson. Obviously, for episode one, we've got to talk about the opening of school, and I have to ask, for you, is this like Christmas, the most fun day of the year, or is it like, oh boy, here we go again?
Yeah, it's a combination. I love the first day of school. As a principal, it was always my favorite because you got to see kids coming back. Kids were excited. As an elementary principal, my favorite part, and some of our employees would tell you this, is like seeing kids in new shoes. They want to show you their new shoes. They want to talk about it. And then as a high school principal, it's seeing kids that you didn't see all summer. You saw some of them through activities, but I always loved the first day of school. Now, as a superintendent and as a district, it's super complex. I think people misunderstand that the opening of school starts in the summer. Mm-hmm. It actually starts back in the spring. And I would say probably the first step of opening school are really two parts. It's starting to hire. We start hiring in early spring, February, March. And then our budget season is really the kickoff of the next school year. And so that component is something that most people don't think about when you're considering the opening of school or the first day of school. I always break the summer up into two parts. The beginning of June is kind of closing out the previous year. And then after the first 2 weeks of June, it's really pushing to open school. And then you know there's a lot that goes into it in the summer. We've got to make sure that bus routes are set. We have to make sure that we're fully staffed, that we have our cafeterias ready. And then our maintenance crew is doing a ton of work around schools. We open in August, which is one of the hottest times of year. And we've got some buildings that struggle with AC. And so we've done a lot of work this summer to make sure that those schools are ready to open and make sure that kids are set up for success. And so opening of school, yes, it is like Christmas. I love it. I love the first day. I don't necessarily love the 6 months leading up to that first day of school.
And you touched on staffing. I've been reading some headline stories around Tennessee, and some counties are having a situation where they have a teacher shortage. Now, I haven't heard about that here. I have heard Zach Brown, who's in charge of your personnel. He's told me that you've hired 200 new teachers roughly for this coming year. But is there a shortage anywhere?
Well, I think that's a complex question. There is a shortage. And what I mean by shortage is you're seeing universities that typically may have been putting out 500 teacher candidates maybe aren't putting out that number. In Hamilton County, it hasn't hit us as hard. And you mentioned Dr. Brown. I would give all the credit to our HR department. They have evolved over the last 5 to 7 years. Their recruitment has gotten better. They've done a better job of onboarding employees. So when we get a new teacher, we provide support for the first 3 years. And so our new teacher retention traditionally has been somewhere around 83%. The past few years, we've been over 91%. We're looking forward to going into this year. 99% of our student-facing positions are filled. So teachers that are in front of kids, counselors, social workers, positions like that, we're about 99% filled. And the last update I got overall, we're just over 96 with when you consider everything, maintenance workers, bus drivers. And so we're in a really good place. And I would say that is because of HR. They not only the recruitment, not only the retention, but they've just adjusted, right? They've adjusted to how we get teachers in classrooms, how we are willing to go outside and recruit talent. And so it hasn't hit us as hard as maybe you would see in other large districts across Tennessee.
Every year I receive from you guys a list of first day enrollment, fifth day, 10th day, maybe 20th day. And it's interesting to watch those numbers shift a little bit as school has started earlier in the past few years than it did traditionally. You've got some families who frankly don't get into place until mid-August or Labor Day or whatever. And so you see some numbers shift and grow. You see some schools that suddenly have 50 more kids than they did last year or 50 fewer than they did last year. And around that 10th day, we start getting complaints in the news media from parents who are saying, you know, my student is in a class with 40 kids, or my student was supposed to have this teacher and now he has another teacher, things of that nature. So tell me how that first 20-day period works when it comes to just putting teachers where they belong.
It's a great question, and it's one that I know it causes a lot of angst for our community and for some of our schools. It's hard to predict. I think we've gotten pretty good at getting close to an enrollment number. But as you said, in some of our schools, that number changes within the first 10 days. The 20th day for us is kind of like the last effort to stabilize schools. And we've held some schools harmless in the past and have had kind of a one-off, like if you're supposed to get a teacher or lose a teacher, we've kind of held people harmless there. We're going to have to be tighter this year, to be honest with you, just because of our budget. And so the way it works is we look at what we predicted. We look at the first day, the fifth day, the 10th day, and then the 20th day to see where enrollment actually came in, right? And that 20th day is traditionally the time where we start to make adjustments to where we may have to move a teacher from one school to another. That's where you get those phone calls, right? Of like, you know, especially, and this is really hard and we recognize it, but at elementary, when you have students have made a bond with the teacher and then we have to move that teacher. It is a budgeting issue though, right? And we've got to be really conservative this year with our staffing because of where we are with our budget. And so we're already looking at those numbers. It's hard to tell right now because kindergarten enrollment is coming in and we don't have all those kids in Power School. And so it looks like we're a little bit lower than where we should be. But in 2 days on August 6th, we expect those numbers to come up. And then 20 days later, of course, we'll look at it and make those adjustments.
I mentioned earlier, I said 75 schools. I may be off a little bit. What's the count now?
Yeah, it's a good, so how do you define a school, yeah, right? And so I talk about in buildings, we've got just over 80 buildings. I think if you talk about school numbers, and I'll give you an example, Normal Park is one school, but it's two buildings. Where CSAS is one building, but it's two school numbers. We just combined Tyner Middle and Tyner High into one school. And so we've got about 80 buildings. And right now, I think the number off the top of my head is 71 actual school numbers. And then when you add charter schools in there, of course, that would go up a little bit.
Well, using the number 75 as a round figure, I try to keep up with principal changes from year to year. I've been doing that for a long time. And I remember some years in the past, there would be just a mass shift of principals, whether it be because of retirements, demotions, people moving out or getting a different career. But I remember one year there was like 17 or 20, and that was the headline of a story. And whoever the superintendent was at that time was not happy to see that number, but it was factual. This year, I didn't see as much. It's nowhere near that number. It's more like 10, give or take. Is that a conscious effort on your part to try to keep some principals in place for a while rather than shift people around?
100% is. I think that year that there was 20 plus, my name may have been in that list. So we've tried to really make sure that we place people in the right fit. And we don't always get it right. And I first wanted to recognize that we have to make some moves. Some of those moves are because of fit. Some of them are because of retirement. Some of them are because of promotions, right? And so we have tried to stabilize leaders in schools. We think that the principal is instrumental in setting the culture of a building. And so by leaving them in place as long as we can, or as long as it makes sense, is a good thing. I would also go back to our leadership development. About 6 years ago, we brought leadership development in-house and created the HCS LEAD program, where we're providing training to assistant principals, to instructional leaders, even to teachers that just want to be in leadership conversations. And part of that is preparing principals. And so I think we've done a better job of preparing principals for that seat. Being a principal is one of the loneliest positions, in some ways even more lonely than superintendent. And so it is it's a high stress job where you've got to make a lot of quick decisions. And so we want to set them up in a way that 5 years down the road, you know, they're still wanting to do the job. They're still in gauged and encouraged. And so I think that decisions that we made 4 and 5 years ago to bring that in-house and then intentionally trying to get the right fits has created, you know, a culture where you're not seeing 20 a year turnover.
When you talk about principal leadership training and that sort of thing, I don't know that anything can be done on a classroom kind of basis that really sets up principals for what reality is for dealing with parents, dealing with the community, dealing with the things they have to deal with. I've noticed in recent years, there seems to be more of a trend to place some retired principals, former principals, whatever the term may be, in sometimes even part-time assistant principal roles to help a new principal. I really like that.
Yeah, I love it. I think about not only the part-time, but also in places where we've had a hard time finding the right person. I think about Allison Taylor at Thrasher the past 2 years. Allison is a tremendous leader that retired, that came back. We thought it would be for a year. We couldn't find the right person. She came back for a second year. So she is a great example of that. We also have, you know, a lot of people that we've used, like you said, is filling AP roles. Mm-hmm. And what it creates for a sitting principal is someone that's done the job, you know, that you can go ask, that can be a mentor to you, that can really help you understand the nuances of different aspects of it. And we have leaders here, luckily in Chattanooga, that when they retire, they stay and they want to be engaged and they want to maybe not work, you know, 260 days a year, but are willing to work 120. And so that's been something that has been really successful. We think that it's good for other leaders, but it's also good for teachers in the building, that they've got an experienced administrator that can provide some guidance and encouragement and just knowledge of how we do this work.
A few days ago, I was at the New Teacher Academy, and among the new teachers I interviewed were several who had been involved in Teach for America or Project Inspire, these programs that train, obviously, generally college students to become teachers. And I want to ask you this, because so many things are happening on a national basis that even a news guy loses track. It seems like occasionally I've read where some of these programs' funding could be in jeopardy for one reason or another. So I guess my question to you is, these very important feeder-type programs that have allowed you to hire teachers from near and far, is that a still a strong thing, or are those programs in jeopardy?
I think it is one strategy for us to make sure, when we talked earlier about having 99% of our teaching positions filled. Those are a couple of strategies. Teach for America is a good example of it. Of how are we recruiting the best talent? Now, there are some funding strategies that are in jeopardy. AmeriCorps is an example. We have some of those programs that take advantage of the AmeriCorps grant, and they are worried about that. We just recently found out in the previous week that some of the federal dollars from at the federal level are being released. We still aren't sure exactly what that looks like. But yes, funding at the federal level, not only for those programs, but for districts across the nation, is something to be concerned about. I know there's a lot of talk about the Department of Education. What does that look like if it goes away? Some of those programs may go to other departments, but there's just a lot of uncertainty at the federal level. And the approach that we've tried to take is, to pause and not try to react too strongly, but make good decisions. And you saw in our budget this past spring that we really tried to make conscious decisions about pulling positions out of grants, and even positions that we ended up cutting. A lot of them came from grants, preparing for these pauses in federal dollars.
We talked about the new school year, things that are new. 30 minutes before we opened these microphones, I was down the street at Tyner. I make sure I get it right. Tyner, oh my gosh.
Rashad
Williams told me, and I wrote it down somewhere, but it's Tyner Middle High Academy. I don't know. But anyway, you got a middle and a high school in the same building. Yeah. Huge building. Beautiful, shiny new building. Let's talk about that. That's got to be like your prize jewel for right now.
I'm excited about it. I'm excited about it because of the community and really the story of what led to that building. So if you remember 4 years ago, you probably ran a couple of stories about this. We had a wall that was literally almost falling over, and we had to shut down three classrooms in one of their buildings.
You had a student walkout.
That's right. And not only a walkout, but we had two or three students that came to the school board meeting and really pressed for this building to come to fruition. It's been something that the district, past administrations, past boards have worked on. And finally, we got some community involvement that I think really pressed the board, pressed the county commission to move forward with it. What's also exciting is, you know, is that building came in over budget. You know, we had budgeted some monies from ESSER, about $34 million out of ESSER to go towards it. The county commission had put some money into it. And this is right around the time that the new county commission and Mayor Womp came on board and found out, I think it was like 17, numbers may be off there, let's say $15 million for an even number, but it was over budget. And we had the decision to make. Do we cut back on some of the programming? Do we make some shortcuts on the building? And I remember sitting in Mayor Womp's office, and he was like, "We're not going to cut back on this. We're going to do it. We're going to get the county commission to approve it." And so that's another part of the story that people don't know, is the leadership from the county commission and from Mayor Womp to say, "We're going to do this," and the school board to say, "We're going to do this." And so this year, you've got an incredible building that the middle and high school will be able to start school in. The football field, hopefully by the third week of the year, will be ready to go, which we're super excited about that. So it's a story of kids. It's a story of political leadership. But I think bigger than that is it's a story about a tradition of Tyner. Tyner's one of those schools that it's like you're three people removed from Tyner. You know, I could probably talk about some of the leaders. I think about a Joe Wingate, former board chair, that's a graduate of Tyner. I think about Lee McDade, who's a former COO of Hamilton County Schools. It's a graduate of Tyner. So it's got a ton of tradition. And for that community to have a crown jewel, you know, if you say of the school system, is a great thing. From an operation standpoint, though, is we took two of the worst buildings in the district offline. Mm-hmm. And so from a deferred maintenance standpoint, we're saving money this year because we're not losing it on bad HVA systems. We're not losing it on lighting that is, you know, out of date. And so we've got to keep a strategy going of trying to reduce the number of buildings that we have, reduce the square footage that we have, because deferred maintenance is still an ongoing issue for us.
It's been interesting. This probably goes back a couple of administrations ago here at Hamilton County Schools. But a trend started 15 years ago, give or take, combining schools, small schools, to make large ones. We've seen that in Middle Valley. We've seen that I'm blanking out right now, but Middle Valley is what I'm thinking of. What's another one that would be a good example of?
Well, you've seen it in Middle Valley. You see
East
it going
Brainerd,
on right now. Yeah, East Brainerd is a good example. See it going on right now with Alpine Crest, DuPont,
right.
Rivermont. It's not new. It's what the community's been doing, and you've seen it.
And East Hamilton was built middle and high. Yeah. Signal Mountain was built middle and high. That's obviously been a trend. Is that working? And I ask that because there are so many parents who, when those schools are closed, the Gans Middle Valleys and the Falling Waters and so on, they're like, you know, I love my little community school. Suddenly my kid's going to be going from a 250 student school to a 900 student school. Hoodoo Elementary, another good example. Is that working? Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I think that we've learned a lot, but I do think that you've got to consider people's perception of their school. And we see this with the district all the time. People, and we've got data to back this up, people love their school. Mm-hmm. Like if you ask someone right now, what do you think about Middle Valley Elementary? The majority of parents are like, I love Middle Valley. When they ask questions about Hamilton County Schools, that's where you get kind of some negative, right? And so when you look at the history of combining schools and some places moving to bigger schools, people see that as a district decision, and there's a lot of anxiety about it. But we've seen those schools work. Middle Valley, I think, is a great example. Ootawah Elementary is thriving, doing a great job.
I forgot about East Ridge Elementary.
East Ridge Elementary is doing really well. We did have a tough time opening Harrison, and I think that in the media, that's gotten a lot. There, a couple of years ago, was getting a lot of negative attention. There were a lot of things that went into that. The pandemic. The building wasn't on time. We had a sinkhole in the middle of it. We had to split kids in between two schools for a semester before we moved them in. And it created just a situation that got that school off to a rough start. Last year, we had a great year at Harrison. We expect to have another good year there. But I think that strategy goes back to what we were talking about, facilities. Community schools are great. Having small schools that or spread out across the community is a really good thing. Maintaining those buildings is really tough. And when you talk about it from a just an operational standpoint, it is difficult to do that. I also look at the high school level and think about operating Lookout Valley Middle High School. Mm-hmm. We struggle to offer to those kids everything that we should be offering. We're at an East Hamilton. When East Hamilton was a middle high school and you had, 1,400 kids there, you had AP classes, you had all kinds of related art options, and kids had a plethora of things to choose from. And so when I think about the experience of a kid, I'm not saying we need to go to 2,500 student schools. I taught at Germantown High School when there were 2,100 kids. I loved it. It was a great experience. Most kids had a great experience. We're not going there. But should we have high schools that are 11, 1,200, 800, 850? We've got to have them big enough that we can provide the options for kids that they need to be successful and that will engage them. ROTC programs, band programs. And so I think that part of it is really important to consider, not just the operational, but the experience that we're providing with kids at those levels. I'll go back to what I started, though. Most parents love their schools. Most kids love their schools. What people question is the big organization. And it's not just with school systems. You see it with government, too.
Yeah. Everybody loves their congressman, but they hate Congress.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that we've got to be very aware of that, of like, and part of, I think, why we're doing this podcast is to really engage the community so they understand why we're making decisions, understand how a big organization works. But I'm excited for what we can provide kids in places like Tyner and places like Middle Valley Elementary.
And on the topic of construction, Tyner is still a work in progress, although it's going to be opening the main building. What about that project you mentioned, on the DuPont property, which will eventually include DuPont, Rivermont, Alpine Crest? Is that getting off the ground, or is that still a few years away?
It's getting off the ground. We hopefully in a week or so we'll have some what I think is really exciting news. We've been working very diligently with the mayor's office to hopefully do something really special at that site. And so it is taking longer than we had hoped. We haven't even put a shovel in the ground yet. And so we are behind what we had hoped, but we're behind because we're working towards something that we're really excited about for that Hickson community.
Couple more topics and we'll let you get back to running schools. And these are timely, I think, as far as the opening of school. Immigration is in the news. Yeah. Again, we see a lot of national headlines about my kids or these kids are afraid to go to school because they're concerned that ICE may swoop in. Parents, teachers, principals have been worried. Some even locally have talked about this. What's happening here?
So we've been very consistent in this messaging and put out to our schools last spring some guidance on what you do if something like that happens. What I want to be very clear about, and I talked to Chief Chambers about this. I've talked to Sheriff Garrett about this. We don't expect anything like that to happen. And so I want to be very clear, right, that we don't think that that's a possibility. But we understand from our Latino community that this is a very real threat, and it's a something that's very real that's caused a lot of anxiety for them. I had the privilege to meet with the small groups, about 50 people from the Latino community last spring, to really hear those concerns. And it had a real impact on me because, you know, these are hardworking people that want to do right, and they're just concerned. And so we've tried to encourage our schools to create safe spaces, to continue to double down on one of our biggest commitments, which is every student belongs. I was super proud of our board last spring when they passed a resolution saying that we wouldn't participate in charging tuition to undocumented students. Number one, we don't know who's undocumented. We that's not part of what we do. We get kids, and our job is to provide opportunities for them to thrive. And so we've equipped schools with some kind of baseline guidance on, you know, if someone comes in, and this isn't anything new, this has always been the case. Schools often, for numerous reasons, have law enforcement or, you know, someone from Department of Children's Services come in. And the same thing is always true. You know, do you have your credentials? So ask those questions. Who are you here to meet with? Why are you meeting? And we can ask those questions and make sure that teachers know that. We sent some guidance out last spring that we'll probably at the beginning of the year send back out to teachers. And so we're trying to equip them to make sure families understand that schools are safe places, that we want their children there. We want them to thrive. And again, I'll go back to how I opened it. We don't expect this to happen. And have had multiple conversations with Sheriff Garrett and Chief Chambers about their approach to it.
And finally, this question is sort of fluid in that things change day to day, but the headlines that we've been reading and broadcasting, new law, no cell phones in the classroom. And then you look down a little later and it says it's up to the counties. And you look down a little later and it says Hamilton County hasn't decided. So here we are on the eve of school beginning. What's up? Can my kid take their cell phone to class or not?
Yeah, that's an ongoing question. We've had so many debates about this in Hamilton County and gotten a ton of input from families. Right now, the policy is still as it was last year, which leaves some discretion to schools. If you're asking me where I think it's going to go, I think that we're going to go to a place where K through 12 kids can bring their devices with them, but they've got to be stowed somewhere where they can't be seen and they can't be heard. So whether that's a backpack or a locker or a car, they won't be able to use. My opinion is we're moving to a place where they won't be able to use them during the school day, unless it's for something like a medical reason, or, you know, a teacher is using it for some reason. But I think that's where we're going to end up. I believe in the August board meeting here in a week or so, there's going to be a new policy passed. And, you know, I'm not speaking for the board, but I think that if you've watched previous board members, that there's board meetings, that there's probably a coalition saying that that's where we want to go. And so that's kind of where I expect that we'll go. And we'll have to figure out when we pivot to that. It's not as easy as just saying the board made this decision. Now Monday it's going to change. We'll have to work with schools. But I've also know that there are a lot of schools that have already started making these decisions of saying, you know, 8 to 3, we're not going to use cell phones even in the cafeteria. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, it's created some distractions. It's created some issues around bullying and things like that. But even 2 years ago, when we changed the policy that took them out except for at lunch and times designated by the principal, I think we've already seen some positive things coming out of that. And so if you were asking me to predict, I would say that at some point in the next month or so, we're probably going to be at a place where they've got to be stowed away in a backpack, in a locker, in a car, or something like that.
And it's possible that by the time someone hears this podcast, a decision will have been made. But that's where it stands as we get ready to open school.
That's right.
Well, I want to say thank you. The very first interview I did with a superintendent decades ago, that superintendent responded to some questions with no comment. You haven't done that, and I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate it. David, you may not remember this, but first year I went to Red Bank High School, you called me up and took me to lunch. I think I still maybe owe you a lunch.
You do, yes.
But the reason why I think it's good to have you on this podcast is community trusts you. And what I've always appreciated about you, you've done some tough stories. There were some tough stories about Red Bank that you did, but you've always been honest with the community. You've always been honest with this district. And so I appreciate you taking the time to do this and looking forward to every 6 weeks sitting down and you throwing me some curveballs.
Hey, you folks listening, if you've got any tough questions for the superintendent, you can find me over at Local 3, and we'll be here in a few weeks.
Then send it to Local 3 or our HCS communications at hcde.org, and we'll get those questions asked and answered. And or if they're just topics, even if you've got a good idea about what we should do on the sections in between the real talk, if you've got a student athlete or a teacher that you think we should highlight, send those ideas into us as well.
Sounds good. Thank you again. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, David.